This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Michael Lally is here with me today, and I'm holding in my hand a 600-page book with some of his 20 or 30 books of poems compiled here. And I've known him for many years, but first of all, we want to hear a couple of pages from this book.
This is from the South Orange Sonnets, 1. In books, it was the Lackawanna Valley. The Lackawanna Railroad ran through it, separating those on the hill from us. Lackawanna Place was the toughest block in the neighborhood until 1952, when the Temptations and Reputation moved to Church Street, where the Pink Devils had roses tattooed between their thumbs and forefingers, wore delicate gold crucifixes on chains around their brown Italian necks, and carried porno playing cards from Newark, the city where parades get lost and statues died, Newark, where we all had lived. 4. In East Orange, Carol Robinson decided I was her boyfriend. Her father found out before I did, told his friends and neighbors how he didn't want no white boy hanging around his little girl. One asked me not to pass the time at his house anymore, listening to his sons, Clifford Browns, or talking to his twin daughters. Walking home that night, three teenagers sitting on a stoop on Halstead Street yelled, "Hey, white boy, what you doing around here? You know where you are? Where you from?" When I answered, "South Orange," this fat girl said, "Shoot, that must be Carl Robb's turkey." 7. One year, our people refused to buy Christmas cards that said season's greetings. A year later, we christened the new homes on the hill Jewstead. 3 years later, we sang Guns for the Arabs, Bicycles and Sneakers for the Jews. Then a year came when the Jewish girls turned soft and ripe and full of round things we longed to hold. That was the year we all wanted to be Jewish. We wanted to kiss the thing they hung on their doors. We wanted to dip our fingers into whatever holy water was theirs. But most of all, we didn't want to wait to be the forbidden goyim they would sneak down from their hill 3 years later to sample. 9. When my mother died, two Irish great aunts came over from New York. The brassy one wore her hat tilted and always sat with her legs wide apart. At the wake, she told me loud, "You look like your grandfather, the cop. If you ever get like him, shoot yourself." The other one waited till after the funeral to pull my ear down to her level and whisper, "You're a good-looking young man, but if you don't shave off them sideburns, people will mistake you for a Puerto Rican." We had so many cousins in our neighborhood, everybody called my mother Aunt Irene, even the Italians.
That is the voice of Michael Lally, and I have missed you so much. That was the first book I knew, even though you had a couple before that. That was the first book I really knew you. Now, if we look at this entire book, Another Way to Play, which is just out, poems from more than 50 years, from 1960 to 2017. What do we know about you, really know about you?
First of all, that I have a compulsion to write poetry and other things.
Clearly.
Particularly poetry. I was born with it. I have no idea where it came from, although I have begun to fathom some possibilities. But my father was a seventh grade dropout, first generation Irish. My grandparents lived down the street Irish. Immigrants, and I had this compulsion to want to write down what I saw in my own experience and the experience of the people in my neighborhood and my clan that I never saw in the media, that I never saw in movies or in books or in radio and later TV and so on.
You are so right. You did. You captured the ethos of that time. But who let you know that it was okay? I mean, how did you know that you could say anything you wanted, any way you wanted, everything you thought and felt? How does that happen to somebody?
Yeah, that is a mystery to me even. I was born, it feels like, with this reaction to the hypocrisy of the times. I was born in the beginning of World War II, so 1942, but growing up in the late 40s, post-war period, McCarthyism and so on, there was just so much hypocrisy, including in my own family and in my neighborhood, people pretending that things I could see were not real. I mean, I would look at a pretty little, my first date when I was 8 years old, I took a classmate, you know, in first grade or whatever it was, to movies for 25 cents, you know.
That's right.
And she was a little girl named Lois Mercadante. She was Italian because my neighborhood was mostly Irish immigrants, but there were Italian immigrants in a nearby neighborhood, and we were starting to, and, you know, it was a scandal, you know what I mean? And I was like, wait a minute, why can't you see how pretty she is? What's it got to do with what clan you're part of?
Isn't
you know?
That interesting that early on you were actually born with wired that way?
Yeah.
To question.
Curious, yeah.
But your mother was kind of the wise woman of the neighborhood.
She
Did
was.
She not appreciate, somebody appreciated you early on?
It was, there were some teachers, but the reaction, you know, there's a thing in the Irish that call a backhanded compliment, right? They can't give a compliment without taking it back at the same time. I used to summarize it by saying, nobody said this specifically to me, but this is what it felt like, what they were saying to me. Oh, you're a good-looking boy. Who the hell do you think you are? You know what I mean? It was like that sense of like, oh, yeah, Michael's very cute, and he can play the piano, and he reads better and all that stuff, but who does he think he is, better than the priest? And it comes, I believe, from the hundreds of years of Irish history where if there were penal codes imposed by the British, and if you stuck your head up too high, you got hung.
Oh, I
do you know what
believe
I mean?
That.
So there was this thing, we'll slap you down before the world does.
But Michael, that is in your poetry.
Mm-hmm.
It is, there is resistance and surrender in all of your work, both of those things. But let's hear some more. This is Michael Lally. The book is Another Way to Play. And we are going to talk about a film that's going to be premiering very soon, too. But give us some poems.
This is in Harlem in 1961, and it's dedicated to a woman named Bambi, who was my first and truest love, and she was African-American at a time. We met in the late 50s, so nobody wanted it. I didn't think about it. I was in Harlem with you. It was 1961, and we were alone in love, uptown, way uptown, on 130-something street heading downtown, where people didn't stare. That's all the way down, although even there, on weekends, if you went out, they might look a little bit longer than they would, not midtown Times Square, where out-of-state sailors on leave left their spit hanging from my action-back skinny shoulders, three-button-high front French sport coat from Klein's on the square in Newark back in Jersey where the rest of the squares didn't want me back no more. Or you saying white and black don't mix like sheep and horses, like cement and fertilizer, like your face and their stomachs, like the way we walk down that dark street after midnight with our hands in each other's, feeling fine, and these little kids not more than 12 years out on the street, not more than 20 strong, stopped us and asked me what the F I was doing up there, out there walking around with you like there was nothing to it but to do it. And I said, what I'm doing is walking on the street with the woman I love.
Mm-hmm.
And I sounded a little afraid, not enough to look like I wouldn't be ready to go down if I had to, but enough to let everybody know I wasn't any hero, including myself. And you looked mad, afraid, and smiling at the same time. And one of the others said, not the leader, said, aw, sheet, let the dude and his woman alone, man. And they did.
Yes. That was one of the many times where you broke convention, which would be a harbinger of your whole life, I would say, that if there was a rule that you felt was unfair, you took it upon yourself to transgress that rule. And it got you in some trouble. It got you to be a hero and an activist. But there was something in you from the beginning that could not tolerate what you felt was unjust. And so that's, I think, the story of your life. But you actually chronicle American culture from the 1940s to the 21st century.
Thank you.
When I look at this book, I know American music, I know American film, I know what we did and who did it.
Thank you so much.
Did you know that?
Yeah, no, I felt like I wanted to do that. I've often been disappointed that no social historian has come along and said, you know, Michael Lally was writing about this.
It is. It's sociology.
Yeah.
It is John Ashbery. It is the civil rights movement. It is a history of our time.
Yeah, the women's movement, the gay rights movement. I ended up joining the service
the Air Force.
Yeah, I joined the Air Force.
I hardly can believe it.
It's ridiculous. Well, Bambi and I had a falling out, and in a typical fashion, I cut off my nose to spite my face. Mm-hmm. You know, I joined the military to show her, and of course ended
they
up—
They didn't like that.
No, they sent me to South Carolina, which was the most segregated state in the country
at
that
point. And you have some poems about that, too.
I do, yeah. And I don't think I picked one. I don't think I have any marked. But, yeah, I ended up getting run out of South Carolina. The sheriff actually came to the Air Force base and said, get this guy out of here.
You know, you have protested for the things that you believed in every venue of your life. And you've been assaulted for it. But did that not wound you?
Yeah, I'll read a poem here that talks about sort of being wounded by the women's movement and the gay rights movement to some extent. As you remember, I came out as gay in 1972, not because I had grown up thinking I was gay or believing I was gay or feeling gay, but because the women's movement opened me up to getting in touch with more things about the possibilities in myself. And because I realized how oppressed gay men were and lesbians and people in what is now called the LGBTQ plus, I can't get all the initials, but I have an excuse, my brain operation. But I came out as gay some gay activist said to me, well, you could call yourself bisexual once I had an experience with men when I was 30. He said, but that would be allowing yourself to have the privilege of having these, you know, sensual encounters with people of your same gender without having to risk the persecution that we get as gay men. So I just said, the heck with it, I'll just say I'm gay. And I did publicly. I marched in the first gay pride parade.
Yes.
I was teaching at Trinity College in D.C.
I got
fired as a result. I had family members that didn't talk to me again and so on. And the commune I was living in, which had been anti-war and pro-civil rights activists, became feminist and then became lesbian feminist. And eventually I moved out, but I was living there with my then wife and children. So I wrote a poem called The Women Are Stronger Than the Men. And I wrote this after all that experience. Always have been. I saw it in the old folks when I was growing up, but then the women also love their men more than their dreams or strength or easy grace for starting over again. But maybe that was because back then the men were really men. I only meant to be more human, more tender and kind and understanding than I remembered any man being for any woman. But who knew what went on when others weren't looking? Now I do my own and my kids' cooking and wonder why I expose myself to so much heartache and heartbreak and unmanly intuitions when what everyone seems to want is the cocky, confident, even arrogant man I was on my way to being before my humanism introduced me to the neo-communism that led me to the super-feminism that helped me turn myself inside out, a person above and beyond his roots, his heritage, his initial influences, looking for a woman who might love me for my variations. They went out to find themselves a real man, and I went out to find myself.
And I remember those days, Michael, but, you know, I remember all of the things you did in the 60s and 70s, but we just thought, oh, that's Michael. We didn't think of you as gay or straight. That was just Michael. He was just always doing everything. Now, I remember when you began Mass Transit, it was a profound, groundbreaking poetry organization which really advanced language and rinsed off language. And I think the last time I saw you is sitting above a bookstore in 1970 or something then. But tell us, first of all, what Mass Transit was, because it's very emblematic of the things you did.
Yeah, when I arrived in 69 to teach at Trinity College, I had gone to the Iowa Writers' Workshop on the TI Bill. And I had come to D.C., I got a teaching job because my then wife, we had two little children, and she didn't want to go anywhere where I didn't have a job, and that's how where I got one. And the only poetry scene in D.C. at that moment was the coffeehouse poetry scene from the Beatnik days had ended, and there wasn't much going on. The Washington Post wasn't reviewing poetry, and there was some academics that had a salon in one of their living rooms. And they were all good poets and nice people, but it wasn't, I was looking for the alternative poetry, that kind that I felt I wrote. And so there was a bookstore that was on M Street called the Community Bookstore, and I think run by a man named David Margolin, was that his name? And we moved it to P Street and into this old house, and there was some rooms upstairs where there was an office, and then there was an empty room where we had community bookstore meetings and various community activist meetings. It didn't have chairs, and it was just this empty room.
We sat on the floor.
So I started this weekly poetry reading. It didn't have a name yet. And I had a few rules because I wanted it not to be like other poetry venues. I wanted it open to people who might be intimidated by the normal poetry venues. So I said, you had to read something of your own. Couldn't last more than 5 minutes. And no one in the room could react. You couldn't applaud or anything like that, so that it wasn't going to be a contest. And we would take up a collection, as you remember, and people would go out and buy some wine or some soda or whatever and some crackers, and we'd sit around on this rug, and people would share their poetry. And it drew in this most eclectic. I mean, there was Ron Morgan, who was black, blind, and gay. Amusu Bolton, who's the late great poet.
There were
people that, you know, had...
They became icons later.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
they needed a place to begin.
Tim Dugos, Terry Winch, all these people. Mm-hmm. And out of it, we started a little magazine called Mass Transit. We started a press called Some of Us Press. Published the first book of Tim Dugos, Bruce Andrews, Lynn Dreyer, Terrence Winch, Ed Cox. I mean, it was just, and we published the South Orange Sonnets.
That's right. Well, I lost track of you after that, and you went to L.A. in the 80s, and somehow all the buzz was, my gosh, he's in the movies. Michael's in the movies. So tell us a little bit about that. There's a poem in your book about being in a film and... with a great film actor. Please tell us a little bit about that story.
Yeah, I had been living in New York with my two children. I'd raised another thing I did early on. I raised my oldest boy from age 5 by myself.
I know your wife
and,
died.
She went into a coma, but we separated before that, and he came to live with me in New York, and my daughter lived with her for a while in D.C., and then she came to live with me. So I had these two children trying to raise them in New York. I was freelancing, doing whatever I could, but it was too expensive. And I got into acting through Karen Allen, who was a member of Mass Transit before she became an actress and a movie star. And she said, you know, Lal, you should try this. So I tried it, and I got some jobs. So I moved to L.A. where the work was. But before I moved there, I was in two horrible horror movies that I was the star of.
and when you look at them today, what do you think?
And I think they're not as bad as I thought they were.
Good.
Yeah. But this is an experience from one of those movies. It's a poem about arthritis dedicated to John Godfrey, who's a wonderful poet who has arthritis. And most of the men in my family had it, including my grandfather, Irish immigrant grandfather, who carried a potato around in his pocket. He thought that worked.
But I think it may have.
I think it may have. And so this is a little section of that long poem. The only encounters I've had with arthritis outside the above, talking about my grandfather and father and brother, were when I made my first movie with a Hollywood star whose hands were so gnarled they looked like mushrooms grew wild under his pale skin. John Carradine played my character's grandfather and still had the force of all the roles I'd seen him play since I was a boy. As he stared at me from behind the camera while I prepared for my close-up at his supposed deathbed, and the director leaned in to whisper in my ear, he'd like to see some tears on my face, and then yelled, "Action!" And I panicked, thinking I'm not good enough to cry on cue. But John Carradine stared into my eyes with the intensity of his. And as I looked away in search of an alternative, I saw his hands, those knuckles erupting under his skin with fierce independence, like an alternative artwork of organic confusion blossoming into fingers that extended in every direction, uncontrollably bent and stiffened and askew. And tears flew from my eyes, much to my surprise, and the rest of the cast and crew, who after cut was shouted, erupted in spontaneous applause, but none from John Carradine, who couldn't have clapped if he'd wanted to. He just kept looking into my eyes as he nodded his head in approval and smiled slyly.
That is my favorite.
Thank you.
Because of 600. I like 600 more. But, you know, here, you didn't know you were going to have to cry, right?
Yeah.
And the director just wanted, and you think, how am I going to do that? And then you looked at his hands, and they reminded you of your father's and your grandfather's.
Exactly.
And the tears came unbidden.
And I live on a Screen Actors Guild pension, which is ridiculous.
Oh.
Because I always consider myself an interloper. Whenever I was on a set, TV show or movie, I always thought, I'm just this poet. I'm this street guy. I don't deserve to be here. I'm not as experienced and talented as all these people. I never doubted my poetry. I was born with that, and that's a gift, and I'm grateful. But I was a jazz pianist, and I doubted my skill, and I was an actor, and I doubted my skill, and I was a screenwriter, and I doubted my skill. But you know, I look back and I go, what are you talking about? You made a living at it for 30 years. You live on a bench.
And was it hard to break in?
Well, it was.
Did you get just lucky? And I mean, you were really so handsome. I mean, that helps.
Well,
did you know someone in the industry?
Actually, I can say about the handsomeness. I would have been all shy about it years ago. But now that I'm an old man, I can say it.
But not as handsome as the priest.
Actually, no, thank you. The handsomeness got in the way. The looks got in the way because they saw me as a leading man right away, and their initial response was I had a very thick Jersey accent, and it was like, you look like a senator and you sound like a stevedore. We don't know what to do with you. So, you know, and if it was a character role and I looked better than the star, well, that doesn't work, you know what I mean? So the niche I found for a number of years that gave me the career was bad guys. Playing bad guys because of the sound of my voice.
You auditioned and just got cold auditions and...
Yeah.
And you managed to do this. You know, you did everything. You've done everything. Read us another poem, and then I have a question to ask you.
Sure. Yeah. Here's a poem that sort of... it's a later poem, but it sort of summarizes also my childhood in a way. It's called To the Light. There was a time when I was a boy, 8 or 9, and afraid of the dark. Even in a tiny house with tons of people, so small it took only a few steps to walk from one side to the other, and not too many more to walk from front to back. In a kitchen off my grandmother's room, right next to it, and on the other side, our little combination dining living room with people listening to the radio or watching the black and white 13-inch TV, siblings or the boarder, upstairs getting ready for bed, light and sound everywhere. Even then, if the light was off in the kitchen, I'd refuse to go in to get something out of the refrigerator without a sister or a brother or someone coming with me. When I got older, so many women would get upset that I left lights on when we went out at night. Every light in the house, they would say, and almost be right. But even though there were times in my life when I loved the dark, relished the dark, immersed myself in the dark, I was always so happy to come home to the light.
Beautiful. I know that poem. You know, you've met so many celebrities and you've lived with the best of them and the worst of them. And I'm very interested in celebrity because it looks like everyone has it all. And then, you know, Kate Spade just committed suicide. Anthony Bourdain just committed suicide. And you say all these people have everything. They have public acclaim. They have money. When you met these people, who did you find that you thought was happy?
Yeah, that's a good question. One of them was Karen Allen, who I met as a young woman in D.C. when she was trying to decide what to do with her life. She was about 20, and she had already had some adventures in the world. She was a very adventurous spirit, and she decided to do acting and then became a movie star, you know, Animal House and Raiders of the Lost Ark and so on, and left D.C. for New York. She lived in L.A. a little bit, but mostly in New York. And we're still very close friends, best friends. And she understood sort of the magic of it. She used to say things like, you know, Lal, doors just started opening when I started in this business. And then at one point they closed and I did something else. And then they opened and then I... So she was open to the... She had this sort of... I used to call her an angel with the kind of innate... I had to learn and study and work on myself to evolve spiritually. She just seemed born with this sort of attitude.
So it's a spiritual thing.
Bright spirit. Yeah, if you've ever seen her, even on screen, she's got the brightest smile. And
so
in person,
you're saying
she's the same
that people
way.
Who tend to want to check out have that... do not have that human spirit.
What I've discovered for myself, and you probably have too, Grace, because you are such a light-hearted and you know, transcended sort of spirit yourself. What I've discovered is that the secret to happiness is gratitude, and that happiness is really is love coming out of my heart.
Yes.
The tendency from people, at least me, and I think most people are like this, the tendency is when something hurts us, and there's so many things in the world that are so hurtful, when something hurts us, I slam my heart shut, thinking that's going to keep the pain out, but that's actually the cause of the pain. The way to solve the pain, S-A-L-V-E, is to keep the heart open. And how do I keep the heart open? What keeps the heart open is... If it gets filled with gratitude, and the more and more gratitude it gets, fills it up, it starts overflowing, and the gratitude coming out is love.
I think that's the last word in your book, love.
Yes,
I believe.
It definitely is.
And there's also a poem about gratitude. When you had brain surgery,
yeah.
After that time, you look at the world anew and see such freshness in it. I wonder if you can find that.
I have it right here. It's a poem called Two Post-Brain Observations, but I'm just going to read the first one because it's such a poem in itself, I think. One, just took a pretty brisk walk several blocks in the cool, crisp air. A bright and shiny day, at times almost chilly, but felt so good to be out and feeling stronger. The caw of a lone crow was so sharp and clarion. It felt like the definition of what it means to be alive. The last leaves still falling, the endless, we hope, natural cycles. How wonderful and fine life is when the possibility of losing it becomes so current and realistic. To be alive, what can disturb the awe of that revelation? Today, nothing.
This book is a soundtrack of your life. And so there is a film now being made of you, and I think it's called, I Want to Call It Poems. Michael Lally, I Want to Call It Poems. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
And what will that be like? What are they trying to do? What do they want from that film about you?
I hope what we've been doing today, because, you know, I think...
Telling the truth.
Rachel E. Dykin, who is the one who's making it, who's this wonderful young poet and playwright, and decided to make this film, just said, you know, you've influenced people in all these different parts of the country, even the world, from her perspective, and nobody's really written about that or talked about it or captured it. I'd like to capture it before it's too late. And since the opportunity came up when this big book came out, she suggested that we make a little book tour to go to some of those places, like coming to D.C., where I'll be reading on Sunday at Politics
and Prose,
with Terrence Winch, and the Berkshires, where my older children live, and where Karen Allen now lives, and L.A. and Hollywood, and
New York. So you're going to
New
all
York.
Those places?
Yeah, and she's going to
film
the
90-minute, 60-minute?
I think a full-length feature is what she intends.
Oh, I will be so happy.
You can go online, I think, and find a little trailer she made with this is her amazing talents. She had never made a film. She had never worked a film camera. She had never done editing. She had never done the whole business. And go and look at that trailer, and you'll see that she taught herself all this stuff to make a little trailer on the first few interviews.
So we can Google Michael Lally, I Want to Call It Poems, and people might get to see that. They'll find it. They'll search for it.
Yeah.
Okay, that will be something we'll be looking forward to. And it'll be such fun to watch you talk about your life, having seen it from a distance and followed it, like watching a meteor, you know, go out all over the place. And so it'll be wonderful to have that chronicled and so well-deserved.
Oh,
let's have
you,
another
Grace.
Poem.
Sure. I'm going to read a poem, My Life. Just My Life too. Grace got
I've
an
read
expression
both of
on
them.
Her face.
I read both of those poems, and that'll be fine. My Life one is a little
about
scary.
About 10 pages long.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a long poem. I tried to write what Jack Kerouac called the eternal sentence, you know, and I figured
it's
the way
true.
To do it was to make lists.
And it says it all.
I was a compulsive list maker, and the day after my brain operation, I couldn't make a list to save my life.
But can you now?
Yeah, but I have to work at it. I need to Google. I need to look at my bookshelves. It used to just be constantly going on in my head.
Yeah, but we all have to Google. And I mean, I don't think it may be about surgery.
Well, it was that abrupt for me. But you're right. It is. So this is My Life too, and it kind of summarized my life. I wrote it when I was, I think, in my 50s. So when I was 10, I thought I was Irish, even though I was born in the USA. When I was 20, I thought I was black. Even though my skin is pink and freckled, my hair is straight, and I have no African ancestry, except, of course, all of our ancestry. When I was 30, I thought I was queer, even though I was married and had two children, and all my fantasies and obsessions and compulsions and attractions were and had always been about women. When I was 40, I thought I was a movie star, even though the movies were terrible and I was terrible in them and almost no one knew them or who I might have been in them. When I was 50, I thought I was enlightened, even though I wasn't. But of course, I was and am enlightened, as I was and still am an Irish black queer movie star.
So true. And we have now time for a final poem.
This is the second part of a poem that I wrote the day after. The first part was the night of the election, last presidential election, and this is the day after. The day after I was born, German U-boat 106 sank a U.S. tanker in the Gulf of Mexico. 22 were killed. Hitler and his allies had been winning World War II, and it looked like they were about to take over the world, including the USA. 3 years later, Germany surrendered and the war in Europe was over, followed pretty soon after by the end of the war in the Pacific. In my brief 3-year-old life, the world had witnessed the greatest death and destruction in the history of humanity. It was tragic and deeply sad, but even so, great acts of courage and kindness, sacrifice and love were committed, great art and music and movies were made, and more. Nothing anywhere near as massively brutal and deadly has occurred since, despite continuing wars and oppression. The world has not, in my now 74 years, ever been as violent or destructive as it was then. That's not to slight the severity of anyone's experience of repression or cruelty, but only to say, as my old friend Hubert Selby used to, that you can't have up without down, success without failure, pleasure without pain. And I would add, dark days without ones filled with light. Let us be the light for those who will need it now.
That is the voice of Michael Lally, who is a cultural hero. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and David Logan Foundation, with additional support from the Sinipid Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.